The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by AT&T Business. Rain Wilson's business advice? Find a network that has your back. That's why he launched a talking pillow powered by AT&T Business's reliability. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com.
LinkedIn presents.
In a pessimistic society, many people measure themselves against one another in a more competitive manner. Somebody else getting more means that you're getting less. Resources are limited. Good fortune is finite. That's antithetical to collaboration and cooperation. It's a force multiplier of grievance.
Hello there, I'm Michael Kovnat. This is The Next Big Idea Daily, a show where we bring you key insights from the best new nonfiction books read to you by the authors themselves. If you like the show, be sure to give us a quick rating or review. So, have you ever been screwed over? Are you nursing any grudges? Have you somehow been victimized by society? If so, you're participating in the great American tradition of grievance, state of mind that is often justified, but has somehow moved close to the center of our culture. That's the argument journalist Frank Bruni makes in his new book, The Age of Grievance. Frank has written for the New York Times for more than 25 years and is the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers. He also teaches in the School of Public Policy at Duke University. Here he is to share his big ideas.
I'm Frank Bruni, a longtime writer and columnist for the New York Times, a professor of journalism and public policy at Duke University, and the author of more than half a dozen books whose variety mirrors the unusual diversity of my journalistic assignments. At the Times, I at one point lived in Rome and covered the Vatican, then later, in New York City, wrote a cocktail column. I was a White House correspondent, the chief restaurant critic, and an op-ed columnist. An early book of mine profiled President George W. Bush. A later book chronicled the senseless madness of the competition to get into elite American colleges. It's my hope that those different vantage points aren't just a curiosity. I'd like to believe that they have given me a panoramic view of society, and that such a view informs my latest book, The Age of Grievance. The Age of Grievance is special to me because it comes at such a consequential crossroads in the American story, and grapples with the enormous challenges of this moment in time. The Age of Grievance reflects on changes I've observed in America and its politics over the past decade, how they came to be, their corrosive impact, and it attempts to point us toward a better, more constructive course. The book's insights are presented and organized in service of that. Here are 5 of those insights. We're fixated on how we've been wronged. A critical mass of people in the United States and in other Western democracies now size up their places in society in a much more negative and divisive way than previous generations did. They methodically tally their slights, some real, some imagined. They're enthralled to their own persecution and intent on identifying the agents of it. The blame game is America's most popular sport. Victimhood is its favorite garb. That, as much as anything else, explains the ascendance and currency of Donald Trump, who has fashioned himself as a martyr determined to strike back at his tormentors on behalf of his similarly oppressed supporters. He's grievance made flesh. He's grudge become president. The rioters at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, had convinced themselves that they were being cheated out of something. Advocacy groups of all kinds lavish more attention on how they've been deprived and on what they're owed than on their visions for the future. Recrimination eclipses aspiration. And you find this mindset among not only the underprivileged, but also the privileged. Even senators and Supreme Court justices sing a song of woe is me. You find it across the entire political spectrum. It's pan-partisan, suprapartisan, and that infuses our cultural and political debates with an ill will that prevents us from forging compromises and finding common ground. Everything is grievance, and grievance often functions as the enemy of progress. We don't vote for, we vote against. I choose candidate A to stop candidate B. I don't so much support candidate A's policies as I want to quash candidate B's. Political scientists coined a phrase for this behavior, negative partisanship, and while they once discussed that as a curiosity, they now recognize it as a pronounced and enduring feature of American political life. To win office, candidates don't just extol their own virtues, they focus even more on their opponents' vices, on the supposed danger if those opponents win. That tactic goes hand in hand with a kind of political polarization more prevalent than before. According to a 2020 poll by the Survey Center on American Life, 64% of Democrats deemed Republican policies to be a serious threat to the country, while 75% of Republicans had that view of Democratic policies. 2 years later, in 2022, the Pew Research Center found that 72% of Republicans considered Democrats immoral. That was a jump of 25 percentage points since 2016, while 63% of Democrats felt the same way about Republicans, a jump of 28 percentage points. Politicians recognize and exploit this reciprocal disdain. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, shaped his political identity around enemies lists and promised acts of retribution. He pledged to eradicate this, exile that, thwart one band of foes and thwack another. That approach was epitomized by his signature promise. Florida, he proclaimed, was where woke goes to die. Negative partisanship this florid creates an ungovernable society. Voters on the losing side of an election don't regard the victor as someone to be tolerated for the time being. They see him or her as someone to be vanquished as soon as possible. Recount. Impeach. These are the battle cries of our times. Grievance thrives because of a crisis of confidence in the future. In the United States, once famous for its optimistic can-do spirit, there has been a violent rupture of the national psyche, and it has given birth to a whole new American pessimism. You see this in survey after survey. The percentage of Americans who believe that their children will live in a better world than they did has been declining. Same with the percentage of Americans who believe that their children will be more affluent. Many Americans have lost faith in social mobility. They no longer believe in or talk of the American dream. Consider this. At least several times a year beginning in 1979, the Gallup organization has polled Americans on the question of whether they are generally satisfied with the way things are going in the United States. Up until 2004, the share of Americans who expressed satisfaction routinely crested 50% and even 60%. But since January 2004, it has never again reached or exceeded 50%. It has almost consistently been below 40%, and it has often dipped below 30 or even 20%. In early January 2021, when the rioters stormed the U.S. Capitol, it plunged to 11%. In a pessimistic society, many people measure themselves against one another in a more competitive manner. Somebody else getting more means that you're getting less. Resources are limited. Good fortune is finite. That's antithetical to collaboration and cooperation. It's a force multiplier of grievance. Changes in traditional media don't help. We frequently and rightly lament the advent and the influence of social media, with its cynical algorithms and its seeding and tilling of anger. But changes in traditional media over the past few decades have also contributed mightily to our sense of grievance and our toxic discourse. Journalism that's infused with opinion is on the rise for two principal reasons. One is that the old advertising-driven revenue model for journalism is in tatters, and commentary is much less costly and more potentially profitable than old-fashioned news gathering. A newsletter, website, or cable news program that peddles sassy, snide, or simply impassioned riffs on existing facts is relatively easy to produce. As a result, such newsletters, websites, and cable news programs proliferate. The other reason for the boom in opinion journalism is the revolution in the ability of news executives to measure how the audience reacts. News executives can see that consumers turn to, click on, and gobble up all these hot takes. So the hot takes keep coming. Meanwhile, the unprecedented competition for attention in our wired world forces news purveyors to scream more and whisper less, to take a five-alarm fire approach to minor blazes as well as raging infernos, emphasizing the direness of conflicts, the magnitude of problems, the ominousness of threats. Television weatherman Al Roker's morning reports aren't just forecasts, they're chilling lamentations about climate change. And that's a metaphor for and emblem of all news coverage, which whips people into a state of panic, hence the neologism doom-scrolling, as it encourages them to have firm, sharp, combative opinions about what's going on. This is a perfect recipe for discord and for dysfunction. We have remedies for grievance. We're not helpless in the face of the forces driving us apart. There are ways in which we can pull closer together, if we prioritize that, and if we put energy into it. I'm not talking about one big solution or just a few bold strokes. I'm talking about dozens of small commitments and steps that, combined, could and would change the emotional weather, minimizing the storms and maximizing the calm. I'll focus on America. We'd benefit mightily from various political reforms, open primaries or jungle primaries, ranked choice voting, an end to gerrymandering, expanded access to voting that boosts voter participation. These changes would function as gauntlets against extremist candidates who promote and popularize extremist views. They'd also increase people's faith and investment in the electoral process. But we haven't thrown enough muscle behind them. We could plan cities and make civic investments in ways that put more value on the mingling of diverse groups of people, that make it more difficult for one group of people to caricature another, that tamp down tribalism. When we locate parks, when we draw bus routes, when we decide whether to invest in public facilities like libraries, we can either increase or decrease the possibility of people from different walks of life crossing paths. Let's increase that possibility. And along the same lines, let's create national service programs that foster interactions that wouldn't otherwise take place, and that stress our shared interests and goals. And let's pay fresh heed to the old virtue of humility. Humility is the antidote to grievance, because it recognizes that the world doesn't conform perfectly to any one person's desires, that life is a mix of blessings and disappointments, and that individual fortune must always be balanced against the common good. In our private and public conversations, we must always remind ourselves of that.
All right, less grievance, more humility. I'm on board. You can get a copy of Frank's book, The Age of Grievance, at your favorite bookstore. Come on back tomorrow when we'll hear from Harvard Business Professor Michael Norton, author of the new book, The Ritual Effect, From Habit to Ritual, Harness the Surprising Power of Everyday Actions. I'm Michael Kovnat. See you tomorrow.